obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, my name is Terry Hankinson and I'm an alcoholic. Because of the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, a woman like me has not had to take a drink since January 28, 1987. And it is going to be hard to go home to my home group because they really don't care about anything except whether I'm willing to clean toilets and pick up cigarette butts. And I've been here, now I kind of feel special because they've been treating me special. So it's going to be a hard transition. Oh, I've had so much fun. I really want to thank Larsine and Dave and the committee for inviting me here. I mean, I can't believe my life. I can't believe my life. And I especially want to thank Sherry and her husband, Dale. And I tell you, I've had that experience. I know what it means to say yes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it has changed my life. You know, it has absolutely changed my life. And I really got to thank Larry, who took me on the poker run this morning. And that was fabulous. And all of you guys. And Larry and I had actually decided, neither one of us knew where we were going, and we decided we didn't care. So it's good that somebody was keeping an eye on us. Oh, it's been fabulous. Yeah, Tim was going to introduce me, and I'm like, yeah, we're like best friends now. Why wouldn't he? And every time I show up for something like this, my world just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it was not like that when I got here. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My sister is here with me, and she actually was my first resentment. I was, we're about a year and a half apart, and I got kicked out of the crib because of her. Yeah. And I remember my dad would put me in the bed and go out to the living room, and I would be right behind him, and he would spank my butt and put me to bed and go to the living room, and I'd be right behind him, and he would spank my butt and put me to bed and go to the living room, and I'd be right behind him. Ominous warning, which they failed to heed. They would not be able to punish me enough or love me enough to get me to do what they wanted me to do. My attitude from the time I was born and out of the crib was no, and you can't make me. And I don't care if you're my parents or a teacher or husband or boyfriend or the cops. No, and you can't make me. And I actually was raised, I would say, in an upper middle class home. My father was in the military, an officer in the Navy, and my mother was a nurse. And we lived in a little court where everybody's dad was in the military, and it seemed like everybody's mom was a nurse. And it was very normal. We played games. Well, it wouldn't be normal today. We played games like Mother May I and Red Rover, Red Rover, and, you know, and it just seemed totally normal to us. And my dad was in the military, so he was gone a lot. And we thought he was like Santa Claus because he'd come home and he'd have armloads of toys or puppies, and we are always so glad to see him. We had no idea that he was like 2 weeks late. You know, we had no idea that alcoholism lived in our home, no idea whatsoever. My mother hid it from us very well. And so when we, my father took us out into the garage and told us that he and my mother were getting a divorce, what I heard was, I don't love you and I'm leaving. And I don't know what anybody else heard, but that is what I heard. And we were the normal family that went to church every Sunday, got all dressed up in our little dresses. And I heard in church that God answers unselfish prayers. And I went to bed every night after that crying myself to sleep that God would keep our family together. Because to me, an 11-year-old kid, that seemed like an unselfish prayer. And when we got in our little Opel Cadet to drive from Virginia Beach, Virginia to Billings, Montana, I made the conscious decision at that moment that the God idea was a big, fat lie. There's no God out there answering unselfish prayers. You can't trust God, and you can't trust your mom and your dad either. And I got to Billings, Montana, a very angry little sixth grader, and it did not take me long to find other angry little kids just like me. And I was a punk, a juvenile delinquent. I mean, literally just a punk. I would just destroy your stuff because I didn't have it. And the first effect, I think, I don't remember if it was my first drink, but the first time I felt the effect produced by alcohol, I was probably 12 or 13 years old, I guess, swimming in the big ditch because you're not allowed to. And I like doing what I'm not allowed to do. So we were all swimming in the big ditch, and we crawled out, and we're laying in the sunshine, and somebody pulled out a bottle of Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. And I tell you, it got to me, and I took a big old drink, and I felt it. I felt it everywhere at once. And I didn't even know it was that bad until it felt that good. And it changed my life. It didn't just change my life, it changed my mother's life and my brother's life and my sister's life from that moment on. And I'm not somebody who ever drank without consequence, not ever. I got in trouble almost every time that I drank. I just didn't care. It was worth the price. And I started ending up in and out of jail. I ran away all the time. My poor mother, first she would nail the window shut, and I would take them out. Then she would nail them on the outside, and my friends would take them out. And then she moved me upstairs next to her, and pretty soon she'd have her chair in front of my room. And it just got to the point where I stood in front of my mother, and I said, "You try and stop me." You know, and I just left whenever I want. I used to think I was a free spirit. You know, I'd just be going along, all of a sudden I got to hit the highway. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys said that was alcoholism. It was called irritable, restless, and discontented. And I just knew that after a little while I had to go, and it didn't matter what kind of trouble I was going to get in. I remember we hit the highway one time and ended up about 250 miles away. I was 13 or 14 years old, I think, and we had a couple bucks, and we're tough little street kids, and we bought a loaf of bread and a package of bologna and a jar of mustard, and, you know, we ran out of bologna because we started off using a lot of bologna, and pretty soon we're down to just mustard and bread, and then we're down to mustard, And I slept with an old man for a can of vegetable soup. And I know I said that from the podium once, and a woman I sponsored was so mad at that old man. And I'm telling you, it wasn't the old man. At 14 years old, that's the kind of alcoholic ego I had. I only needed to make a phone call, and my mom would have been there right there with all the food I needed and a warm place to sleep. But no, not me. And so that's the kind of stuff that I was getting into at a really young age. I was sexually active very early. My first sexual experience was rape. And really my reaction to that was not so much, this was horrible. My reaction really was like, wow, men will do anything for that. And I used that to get what I needed. I didn't recognize that I was selling my soul one little piece at a time for just a little sense of security or safety or love. That's not what it looked like to me until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was a runaway, a punk, in and out of jail, and I ended up in reform school, and it was not a fun place to be. I was the only white girl there, and later they turned it co-ed, and I'd have signed up for that because I like those kind of guys. But when I was there, it was not co-ed. And I remember getting out of there and thinking nobody was going to own me like that again. And I managed to stay out of jail from that point on. And I thought it was me. But today I recognize it was not me. So I ended up back in school and I just ran with some really tough people. I ran away again after that the following summer, and I ended up living with a motorcycle club. There are three motorcycle clubs, and you picked who you were going to be with, or you were going to be with everybody, and that's just the way that it was. And I spent a summer there, and I experienced things that 14-year-old girls just really shouldn't experience. And I never thought it was bad. I thought it was exciting. It was exciting for me. And there was a point, there was an outlaw motorcycle come to town, and they were the clubs were going to war, and they were nailing the windows closed and getting, and I was not afraid. I was excited. I mean, I do not know the right things to be afraid of. You know, I'm not afraid to go down the highway 140 miles an hour on a Harley at night, but I am afraid to pray. You know, I do not know what to be afraid of. So I got out of reform school, and my behavior did not change at all, and I ended up pregnant as a senior in high school. And my mother instantly wanted me to have an abortion, and no, you can't make me. It's not like I had any moral disagreement with that. It's just if she'd have said, you will have that baby, I'd have said, no, I'm having an abortion. And so I decide as a senior in high school that I'm going to be a mom. And I move off to this little town to play grown up with my boyfriend. And I lasted about 3 months, you know, and I begged my mom to come home, and I gave that baby up for adoption. And I think that's really the only unselfish act that I did until I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I look back and see what I would have drugged that baby through. And I, back in the early 70s, you weren't a pregnant cheerleader like they were when my son went to school. You know, they hit us around, hit us in homes for unwed mothers, or, you know, in the basement or something like that. But I ended up going to night school and getting all my credits for high school. I mean, I barely showed up, but because reform school and night school, I ended up with all my credits, and I demanded that I go back, be transferred back to my high school so I can walk down the aisle, because I have worked so hard, don't you know? And oh, it's ridiculous. And so I did. And the truth is that, you know, I had hopes and I had dreams, and I was enrolled in the Colorado Institute of Art, and I got drunk and missed it with my girlfriend's boyfriend, who was actually married to somebody else, but and whom then I married once he got rid of his wife and my girlfriend. And so I was 19 years old, and I married this man, and I'm sure my mom was thinking, you know, thank God, you know, maybe she'll settle down, or maybe he'll take care of her. And but what happened is he drank like I did, and it turned into a really violent relationship, and there was a lot of physical beating between us, and I would like to say that it was all him, but it was not. If he didn't start it, I did, and he was a foot taller and 100 pounds heavier, and I don't care. You know, I'm a rowdy kind of drunk. I like to fight, roll around in the mud and the blood and the beer, and if I'm there, you can usually hear me. You know, I like to have a good time, and pretty soon our friends wouldn't hang around with us because you don't know what's going to happen when Terry and Ray start drinking. And one night in particular, I'd gone out, and I asked him to come because I'm polite like that. And and he didn't want to go. And so I got home, you know, at 5, right? You get home at 5 in the morning, and he wasn't there. And I remember at that time feeling angry that I'd asked him to go out and he wouldn't go out with me, but then he went out. And for some reason, I didn't have a key to get in the house. And so I passed out in the car, and a couple hours later woke up and he still wasn't there. And I crawled in the window because I don't have a key to my own house. And I found a note, and it said that he had left me. And I remember thinking, he left me? You know, he's the sick, violent, crazy one, and he left me. And today I look back and I think, thank God, you know, because I'm not the kind of woman who leaves those situations. You know, I could be dead or he could be dead, but then he's gone. I have no mother looking over my shoulder. I have no husband telling me what to do, and the party was on. And I was 20 years old and a full-blown alcoholic, drinking every single day and whatever else was available. And at the same time, I got a job with the government, and that's way... ended up way too much money for a girl my age. And I think of that, and almost immediately I was spending my whole check on Friday, and Monday waking up scared about how I was going to pay my rent or pay my bills. And about the same time I end up pregnant again, and there was no question this time, no question. You know, I got an abortion. There's just no way I could have done anything else. And I don't know what you do with that, but I leave the clinic and I go to the bar and I have a drink and I don't tell a single soul, nobody. And that's kind of what my drinking started looking like. And I was doing things that I couldn't tell my best friend about, and pretty soon it's like nobody even knows who I really am. You know, I have the shame and guilt of giving that first child away, and then the shame and guilt of having an abortion, and I'm waking up in strange houses. This one time I woke up, and I just remember these vivid memories. I woke up at this house, and I'd been partying with the motorcycle club, and I woke up and my face was stuck to the pillow because I had vomited at some point. I'd been up for days and days and days and days, and there was nobody there, and I did not know where I was. I didn't recognize the house. And I remember going into the bathroom and thinking, what have you done? And it wasn't really like, what have you done? It's like, what have you done again? Like, how do we keep ending up in this place? And, you know, but something would always happen and it would end up okay. But little by little, my drinking becomes, it was so fun in the beginning. It was so much fun. But by now I'm 22 years old and I'm drinking to hide from what I do when I drink. And I'm in and out of relationships, but I always have one because I need to have something to fall back on. I need somebody to need me. I need some kind of self-worth, and I have none if I don't have some guy hanging out with me. And I met this guy on accident because I thought he was somebody else. And we ended up in a relationship for years. I had his child, and I didn't even mean to be with him. I meant to be with somebody else. But I was telling Larry about it earlier because this is my alcoholic ego. I bought him a Harley for his birthday so he would be cool enough to go out with me. Yeah, I know. It's insane. I mean, the idea that I felt so low about myself and so highly about myself at the same time, my whole life was just a contradiction in terms. And but my drinking was getting very, very monotonous. And I ended up pregnant again. And, you know, some people talk about not being able to look at themselves in the mirror, but I'm the one who's always standing in front of the mirror giving myself little talks, right? And we're not going to do this tonight, and we're not going to go there tonight, and I end up pregnant again, and this is right after I'd been to a motorcycle rally, and I'm the kind of drunk that thinks that you can dance with three bikers at once and it stops there when I say no, and that's not what happened. I was gang raped, and you know, I don't know what you do with that, but I get dressed and I go back to the keg and I pour myself a beer and I don't tell a single soul. You know, and my life is just full of secrets and shame and self-loathing, and I end up pregnant again, and I'm standing in front of the mirror going, okay, Terry, you gave one away. You killed one. it's time to step up to the plate and be a mom, you know. And people have been telling me, you know, you need to cut back on your drinking or you need to quit drinking. And I always told them, when I'm ready, I'll quit when I'm ready. And I'm looking in the mirror going, it's time. You know, you're pregnant. It's time to step up to the plate and be a mom. And I made a decision right there that I was going to quit drinking and all that other stuff that I was doing. And I could not. I was scared to death to find out that the next day I took a drink, and the next day, and the next day, and every day I was pregnant, I drank and used. And I woke up every single morning hating myself, full of self-hate and shame. And I was about 6 months pregnant, and I'd partied all night. I hadn't slept for days, partied all night with my girlfriend's boyfriend, and went to work that day. I hadn't eaten, and when I got home from work, I mean, I was just jonesing, and I was crazy, and it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm going to bed. By this time, my sister and I are living together in my mother's house, because at first, I ran away all the time, but by the time I got 18 and responsible for my own life, I started coming home all the time. And my mom moved out of her own house. And, you know, sometimes we laugh about that, but the truth is that my mom got to a place where she couldn't say no, you know, and she had to leave the state because she didn't want to watch us die. And so it was my sister and I living together, and I get home at 4 in the afternoon, and she's at work, and I go to bed, and the phone just starts ringing off the hook, and I'm a complete crazy woman. I'm screaming at the phone, shut up, shut up, and finally it stops, and I go to bed, and about 10 o'clock that night, the doorbell rings, and it's the cops. My sister answers the door, and we're living like alcoholics, you know, with the curtains closed. We don't answer the door. I work for the post office, but I don't look at my mail. They eventually send it back, even though they know I work there and live there. They return my mail to sender. But, I mean, you know, we just live in the dark is what we were doing. And the doorbell rang, and she answered it, and it's the cops, and they asked for me. And for some crazy reason, she came and got me, and I went out there, and he asked if I was Terry, and I said yes. And he said, do you know Sandy Kusan? I said, yeah, it's my baby sister. And he said, she was shot this afternoon. And I'm like, oh my God, how is she? And he goes, no, your sister was shot and killed this afternoon. And what had happened is my little sister got herself in some trouble, and she was calling me for help. And I was too messed up to pick up the phone, and she was brutally beaten and sodomized and shot. And I don't know what you do with that, but I go to the bar and I take a drink, and I drank everything I could get my hands on. I did everything I could get my hands on. I couldn't drink enough or snort enough or take enough or smoke enough to make it go away. And I spent literally the next probably 8 months just trying to kill myself with drinking. And we ended up going to the trial for that guy 2 days after my baby was born. And I remember they had a baby shower for me, and all the women there explained to me when they put that baby in my arms that I would just be overwhelmed with this maternal instinct. And I remember they put that baby in my arms, and I felt nothing, absolutely nothing. And I gave that baby back to the nurse, and I called my boyfriend. I said, you got to bring me something. And but today he was 2 days old, and we went to Nevada for the murder trial. And I would stand back there where they would bring him up, you know, in chains, and I would stand there in the doorway, and I would just try and kill him with my eyes. I was so filled with so much hate. And every day I would stand there, and every night I would go get drunk, and I did things that in that town that I'm ashamed of today. I mean, I know that you know, I was doing the best that I could, but still sometimes I think back and I was there with my parents and my mother's little baby had been killed and I could not not drink there and I could not be a mother to that child. And at the end of the trial, that guy got 2 life sentences without parole and I thought I would feel better and I did not. She was dead because I didn't pick up the phone. My mom was going through what she was going through because I didn't pick up the phone, and it was my fault. And I had that little baby, and I went home, and I just drank, you know, and everything else I can. And I never held that baby to feed him. I would prop his bottle. I bathed him. And there were times that I was in the parking lot of the grocery store, and I made the decision to dilute the baby formula so I would have enough money for vodka and baby formula. And I'm not proud of that, but that's the way it was. And I would guzzle vodka at night so that I could shut my head down and pass out and go to sleep. And I would get up in the morning and do a blast so I could do the day. And then I would get home and I would guzzle vodka so I could shut my head off and go to sleep at night. My world got this small. There used to be a story in the back of the big book. I don't know if I can remember, but I think it was the Golden Slipper. And there was a line in there that said, "Alcohol gave me wings to fly, and then it took away the sky." And that is exactly what happened to me. What it started out so good just had me trapped. And Super Bowl Sunday, 1987, I have this little 4-month-old baby, and I'd been out the whole night before partying and passed out on the couch, and the doorbell rings because the party's at our house. And that day, I remember, I was drinking vodka straight out of the bottle, and I was snorting cocaine out of a baggie with a tablespoon. I could not get enough. And that night when everybody was gone and my boyfriend went to bed, I was stone cold, straight, sober, and scared to death. And I got up the next morning and I did not take a drink. I did not do anything. What happened for me is at the same time I ran out of friends and family and money and energy to do what I needed to do to get what I needed. I just couldn't do it one more day. And I didn't drink Monday, and I didn't drink Tuesday. And by Wednesday, you know, I'm a daily drinker. By Wednesday, I'm going crazy. And that night, I decided that it's too big. It's too bad. I can't do it. And my father had come back into our lives when I was about 14 and remarried my mother. And when I ended up in reform school, and I remember he called me in reform school and he said, "Your mother and I are getting a divorce." And what I heard is, "It's your fault," you know. And I had this hate-love relationship with my father, you know. I hated that I loved my father. I hated that it mattered to me what he thought about me. And so...
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Anyways, my father had taught me that if you're going to have a gun, it should be loaded, and if you're going to point a gun at somebody, then you better be willing to shoot them. And I remember that when we were little kids, my dad would hang us from his muscles. He would have us punch him in the stomach, and then he'd say, "Oh, you can't hurt steel," you know. And those are the lessons I learned from my dad, and I just became steel. But that night, what I remembered is my dad had guns. And I made a decision that the only way to fix this big mess was to end it. And I made a decision on that Wednesday night to go to my dad's the next day and commit suicide. And I, for the first time, I think in years, I started going to sleep. I felt a level of peace I had not known for years. And about that time, that baby started crying. That four-month-old little baby started crying, and I thought, my God, I cannot kill myself and let that baby grow up thinking its mom didn't even care enough to stay alive. And I didn't do it, and I didn't drink Thursday. And by Friday, I was completely crazy, and I got this phone call from that crazy ex-husband, and the one that we had gotten divorced, that we fought all the time. And for 4 years after our divorce, he would stalk me. I mean, I moved every time he found out where I lived. But I picked up the phone that night, and it was him, and he asked me how I was doing. And for some reason, I told him the truth. I said, I can't do it, not one more day. I cannot. I'm not going to make it. And he came over. He was 2 years sober, and he was calling me to make amends. And kind of my first sign that the God idea is in a big fat lie, you know. And he took us to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all I remember from that is that it was dark. It was really dark, and it wasn't, as it turns out. That was just my memory of it, that it was really dark. And but really, all I heard somebody say, you don't have to drink anymore, and we'll show you how. And it got me there the next night. And not only that, my sister who lived with me, she was at that first meeting with me also, and she and I share the same sobriety date. I'm here to tell you my mother loves the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That first meeting we went to, she called us about 10 minutes before the meeting because that's just what she would do. She would call once a month and just see if we were there, if we were alive. And she called this time. She said, what are you girls doing? And I said, we're on our way to an AA meeting. And she just started crying. And she said, thank God. And so we just started going to meetings. I mean, meetings and meetings and meetings. I had a four-month-old baby, and every once in a while I'd say, I feel guilty because I have this little baby and I should be home. And they would tell me, you know, it's not the quality, it's not the quantity, it's the quality. He's going to have a lot better mother if he keeps coming here. And we ended up in treatment. We, Carol and I, ended up in outpatient treatment and going to meetings. And we got sponsors. I got a sponsor. I was in aftercare, and the woman there wouldn't let me loose until I got a sponsor. And I remember she said, you got a sponsor? I said, why don't you be my sponsor? And she's like, all right. All right. Like, oh, no. And so then she got transferred almost immediately, and she said I had to find another sponsor, and I picked one out. She's a really nice girl, and she said, oh, no. Oh, no, Leroy is going to be your sponsor. And he was the steward of the AA group. We were going, like, he lived there, you know, and he was like 120, and he was a grizzled old man. He wasn't nice, you know. He was actually a horse's, yeah. And I told her that, and she goes, yeah, just like you. And so Leroy became my sponsor, and he was very involved in general service, and I was a GSR before I even knew what one was, and I was at absolutely every service function going on and every conference going on, and I was at area assembly, and I was busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and life was good. I mean, I felt like the obsession to drink was removed almost immediately for me, and I was busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, as was my sister, and life just got good. I'm telling you, life just got good, and I'm holding that baby and feeding that baby and holding him during the Lord's Prayer, and, you know, he's in the back room playing or somebody's holding him, And that went on for about 3 years, and at about 3 years sober, something happened. I mean, my life turned dark again, and I started feeling all that self-loathing and shame and guilt, and I started thinking that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work. You know, I'd been here 3 years, busy doing service work, and AA didn't work, and I'd been in and out of a relationship by that time. And I went to a meeting where they asked, does anybody have a topic, solution, or problem? And always a problem. Everybody always picked a problem, and somebody would share their problem, and the next person would share their experience with that problem, and the next person would share their experience with that problem. And we never had any solution, but we felt very unified that we all had the same problem. And this one particular Sunday, this woman had showed up, and I mean, I'm barely staying in my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she showed up and they did the same thing. They brought up the problem and it gets to her, and she reached under the coffee table and dusted off this blue book and turned to a page and said something like, spiritual principles will solve all my problems. Some, you know, and everybody was like kind of ticked off, really, you know. But I was not. I heard that, and after the meeting I asked her for her phone number, and the next week she was at that meeting, and I had the guts to ask her to be my sponsor. And she lined me out what that was going to look like. See, I thought I had done Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been sitting in a couple meetings a day every single day, and I'd been going to area assembly and district and involved in all this stuff, and I had never worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been sitting in AA for 3 years, and I'd never even done the program. And I could have died thinking I'd done AA, and I hadn't even done AA. And this woman took me, and she told me what it was going to look like. You know, she said, you're going to show up at my house once a week for an hour, and we're going to read the big book. We're going to start at the beginning. We're going to read every single word. When we get to a question, we're going to answer it. When we get to a step, we're going to work it just like it's laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm telling you, that process transformed me from the inside out. That shame and guilt and self-loathing, it transformed me as a person. And I remember we got to that third step. And when I got to, when that crazy ex-husband 12-stepped us, he asked if I was willing to pray. And I hated God because my sister who'd been murdered loved Jesus. And if that's what happens to Jesus's kids, you know, I really don't want anything. And besides, it's a big fat lie, right? And but I was willing to do it. You know, the old no and you can't make me, you know, was just literally beat out of me by alcohol. And I got on my knees and I prayed just in case. And I had been praying every day just in case. And we got to that third step and she got on her knees and held my hand and we said that prayer. And I got to tell you, I didn't feel anything, you know, like I'd heard in meetings. I didn't feel anything, but we got immediately into that fourth step, and I told all those secrets that I'd never told anybody in my whole life. And I didn't care if she didn't like me when I was done. I didn't care what she thought of me when I was done. And I remember finishing that fifth step with her, and she grabbed my cheeks with her hand, and she said, "Baby, that was the best you could do without God's help. But now you got God's help." And I felt it, you know, kind of slide away. But I did not get the pink cloud people talked about after the fifth step. It was like I quit running, turned around to face the monster, and it was me. It was me. And we kept going through the steps, and I got to the ninth step, and that is really where it happened for me. It's really where my relationship with God happened to me. You know, I used to argue in AA meetings, yeah, I'm willing to believe if you can prove it. You know, if you can prove it, I will believe it. And then one day, this guy showed up in our AA meeting, and his name was Forklift Jim. It's Montana, right? And I'd been arguing with people about God for a long time, and it got to him, and he said, "Hi, my name's Forklift Jim, and you got to give up to win, I'll pass." And I don't know if anybody else heard it, but I had a spiritual experience at that moment. And I quit debating, and I became willing to entertain some new ideas about a power greater than myself. And I got willing to look honestly at my life and look that the God idea was not a big fat lie, that God has used my pain, and that God gives my pain purpose, and that he has used the most unlikely circumstances to bring about the miracle of recovery in my life. And I started making those amends, and to my mother, and I remember my mother just looking at me and going, she couldn't deny anything. Like, she couldn't say, oh, it wasn't that bad. I remember her saying, yeah, but you were so sensitive. And where I had learned in AA, it was one of our grosser handicaps. So that was, yeah. And I remember going and making amends to my father. The truth was is that he had harmed me. He beat me. He called me a whore. I mean, just, you know, he was not a good father. And but the truth was is I was not a good daughter. And when I went to make amends to my father, who was a chronic alcoholic, I went to his home and I told him what I was about to do. And he said, I don't want to hear that crap. I want you to sit down and watch a Kentucky Derby with me. And that was my amends to my father. And it was good enough. And I was free from the resentment for my father. And he never, ever told me he was sorry. And I had always had this idea that for me to be free of my anger or pain, people were going to have to tell me they were sorry. And it was not. It was completely the opposite. When I went and I made amends to them, I was free of the pain and anger and resentment. And as a matter of fact, a couple of years after that, I guess I was 12 years sober. Well, earlier, my father had broken his hip, and they put him in a nursing home to recover. So he called his friends at the bar, who snuck his car down to the nursing home and left the keys in it so he could escape. So then when I was 12 years sober, he got really, really sick, and one of his friends called me, and we went up there, and I said, you got to go to the hospital. And he goes, I'm not going. They'll keep me. And I said, if you don't want to stay, they can't keep you. And I took my father to the hospital, and they said if they didn't admit him immediately, then he would be dead within 2 or 3 weeks. And my dad didn't want to stay. And so I took him home to die. And my dad died in my home under my care. I washed his body. That mountain of a man was like 86 pounds. I could have picked him up myself. And I fed him morphine in his mouth to keep him comfortable, and he died in my home. And I do not think I will ever experience that level of humility, ever again. There was no anger, there was no resentment, there was just love for a suffering alcoholic. That's all I felt. And those are the kind of experiences I've had as a result of my amends. And raising this little boy in Alcoholics Anonymous has been a treat. I'm not a good mother. It wasn't a planned thing. I don't have the mothering skill, to tell you the truth. I mean, when I got sober and got my own Harley, I knew I'm a mother. I should spend time with my kid, but I got this bike in the garage, and my solution is to bungee cord him to the backrest. Yeah, that's what I did. You know, his helmet was bigger than him. Boing, boing, boing. Yeah, I'm sure I'd be in jail for that today, but that was my solution. And I mean, you guys raised my son. And there was times where one time in particular, he played sports. We were from a very small town, so everybody got to play sports, right? And so he sucked, and he would tell you he sucked, but he just liked to play, and he just did not have what I had growing up. He did not have that barrier between him and other people. He just did not have that. And this particular basketball game, and the whole town knew he sucked too, by the way. And he was fouled, you know, and so he got 2 free shots, and everybody's like going, oh, Danner, you know, and we love Danner. And so he gets up there, and he makes the shot, and he makes it, and the crowd goes wild. I mean, everybody's going crazy. Gets up, makes the second shot, and he misses it. So we're going home that night. I'm like, wow, that was a great shot. He goes, yeah, I stopped. I paused. I prayed. And I made it. And he goes, but I was so excited I forgot to pray at the second shot and I missed. And I'm like, you stopped. You paused. You prayed. You know, I'm like, where did you learn that? You know, he learned that having women in and out of our house and sitting at our kitchen table and doing third steps and in AA meetings, doing the serenity prayer. And I mean, he learned watching it. He learned watching it. And he's a freak of nature. I don't think he's got this thing. And he was 21 years old, bought his own home. You know, I was 21 years old, sleeping on couches. He was in the pep band and the bleachers. I was under the bleachers, half naked, drinking Mad Dog 2020. I mean, he's just like nothing like this, you know. But if it turns out that he is, I don't have to worry because he knows where to go. It's been his whole life. One time he called me. He calls me. I'm at coffee with my sponsor, and he calls me and he goes, "Hey, Mom, how you doing?" "Good." And he goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm having coffee with my sponsor." And he goes, "Oh." And I said, "Well, what are you doing?" He goes, "Well, I'm gonna go get a tattoo." I'm like, "Oh." I'm making this face to my sponsor. "Oh my God!" But I'm saying to him, "Oh, cool." And he goes, "Yeah." And he tells me what he's going to get, Incubus or some CD cover. I'm like, "Cool. Oh, that's cool." Making face at my sponsor. "Oh, my God." And he's like, "Really? Would you go with me?" And I'm like, "Yeah, of course I will." And I went with my son to get his first tattoo and taking pictures, you know, and we get all done and we go to dinner. He goes, I got to tell you, Mom, I was kind of surprised by your reaction. And I said, "Son, this is your life. And you get to make the decisions. And I'm just going to support you for them and respect you for them." And you guys taught me that. You guys taught me that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so many other things that you taught me here. The relationship with my son is tremendous. He took me with him to buy the engagement ring. He took me. And when she left him, he came to me. And these are things I would have never been able to experience. I would have never been here to have the life that I have. I turned 50. I got married in AA and divorced in AA. At 14 years of sobriety, he drank again, and I left him. Some people can stay. I could not. I mean, I started talking to myself in the mirror again. My emotional sobriety was gone, and I knew that physical sobriety was right behind it, and I had to leave. And I spent 7 years single and happy and growing spiritually in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I turned 50, I realized, whoa, you know, life is happening right now. And I want to do it. So I bought a house and lived by myself for the first time in my life at 50. And it was fabulous, except for one night while I was sleeping, the ice dropped down. So the next, I didn't know what it was, so I got a security system and a Glock. I just want to be safe. And I also started taking piano lessons.
Oh, that's cool.
When he started playing the piano, it was a message from God for me. You know, he's like, "I'm here. This is for you, baby." And, you know, my whole life, all my mom ever wanted was a good little girl who played the piano. And last year, I had my first recital. And and my 78-year-old mother was in the audience. And she has her good little girl who plays the piano. And I cannot believe my life. I cannot believe what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, have done for a woman like me. And 26 years ago, I got on my knees and I said a prayer just in case. And I've not had a drink since. That's powerful stuff. May you find that power. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.